I've entitled this Angels on the Edge of Their Seats. I don't know about you, let me back up a little bit. I really enjoy coming and being a part of your community, so thanks for the invitation. It's good to be here. I don't know about you, but there are some Bible characters that I seem to relate to better than others, and I've been listening to the Bible in a year when I walk the dog via the Bible Project. And lately I've been in the story of Samuel, Saul, and David, and Jonathan. I understand that David was a man after God's own heart, but I find myself actually conflicted about that. I read about his life, and then I get to thinking, you know, well, maybe I'm not so bad after all, which probably isn't the point, mainly because that's a works righteousness kind of thing, right? Kind of reaction. But what's worse, I should say, is that in those stories, I find myself actually more interested in the bodyguards of the kings and how brutal they could be. I know this is bad. I'm a Mennonite guy and all this kind of stuff. It focuses on violence, and it's not good. Anyway, let's take Abner, Saul's bodyguard, as an example. He's running away from a guy named Asahel, and he warns him to stop following him, or he would have no choice but to kill him. Maybe you remember this story. I'm not sure if you do. Asahel, of course, doesn't stop pursuing him, and Abner, a man of his word, kills him. You know, I confess to having similar conversations of this genre, though less violent, with my younger brother Steve when we were kids. They went something like this: Steve, if you don't stop bugging me, I'm going to pound you until you start crying, and then you're going to run to Mom. And he wouldn't stop, of course, and so I would have to follow through as a boy of principle. Asahel, as Joab's brother, by the way, well, who was Joab's brother, by the way? And Joab was David's bodyguard, right? So these two bodyguards of the kings. Joab wasn't the forgiving type, it turns out, and he made sure to revenge kill Abner in a private chamber, luring him in by suggesting that, hey, can you come over here? I need to have a private conversation with you. So when it comes to the New Testament and the many characters therein, besides Jesus, of course, I am actually drawn to Peter quite a bit. When you look at his life in the Gospels and in Acts, you see how interesting his life was as he followed Christ. Certainly his spiritual life was not linear, right? It's not in that it was always about it was not always about improving or not making mistakes. Rather, it seemed to go in fits and starts, great in one moment, right, when the spotlight was on him, and just terrible the next time the spotlight was on him. And yet the events of his life with Christ and then after Christ's ascension seem so incredible, I think, even now. From that first meeting with Jesus, when Jesus came into the house and he healed his mother-in-law, right, in Luke 4, to hearing that rooster crow three times, and I don't know if Peter actually ever hated roosters from there on in, or if he loved them from there on in, I'm not sure. To those times that time when he wanted to go fishing, when he couldn't figure things out after the resurrection. To those restoring, life-changing words from Jesus after that fishing incident there. To that first church meeting where Ananias and Sapphira died. And to visions of clean and unclean foods. Peter didn't have it dull. And after all those experiences, he manages to write a couple of books for us, and they continue to ring true even in our current age. And I just find Peter really, really great to consider. And so we come to his first letter, and there are a few things we should note by way of context as he writes 1 Peter. First, this section from his letter is a very appropriate message or passage given that we've just come through the season of Easter. Second, Peter understands what it means to follow Christ in an adversarial environment. The time of his writing was about 60 AD or so, and so the believers, especially in Rome, were nearing the time of a formal persecution by Nero, though not yet having been blamed for the fires of Rome in about 64 AD or so. Additionally, Peter was writing from Rome, a place he called Babylon, as we've talked about earlier today, at the close of this letter, so as to signify it as the power center of a world hostile to God's people. Peter was writing to people who were wanting to follow Christ in an environment that wasn't exactly friendly to the idea. And so it resonates with us even today. So as we look at our first three verses in this passage, we should make some note of Peter's use of language. First, Peter introduces himself as an apostle of Jesus Christ. That may not seem significant, but at the outset, we see that Peter is describing himself with some humility, of course, but also, in some sense, also with authority. Peter knows that Jesus is Lord, and that it is Jesus who sends him and who's actually behind this message, right? His life and ministry and all those sorts of things. And so as Peter writes this letter, he also carries authority as somebody who actually spent the time with Jesus, right? Who had been with Jesus for all of those events. His letter contains apostolic authority, and it's important for his readers to understand this, and especially for the church in its infancy stages. I know I think about this often. My faith relies often on the bearing witness of those who were with Jesus during the events around his earthly ministry. And I often find myself giving thanks to God that they were able to record those events so that we might believe as well, but also to be encouraged in our faith even today. Second, and still in verse 1, you can see that Peter uses language like God's elect, as Dave was reading about, and exiles, as he describes his readers. And this language ought to alert us to the fact that he is relying on the history of the Israelites as he writes this particular book, but also applying those experiences then to these believers post-resurrection. When Peter talks about God's elect, some might have the compulsion to think in terms of theological categories, as in, Peter sure sounds like a Calvinist here. It's a shame that Peter had no idea who John Calvin was, and so perhaps it's better to see this as who is the ultimate agent in terms of who is responsible for the development of the people of God. God is the one who did the electing, turns out, and this ought to remind us of how God chose the people of Israel as well. You may recall God's dealing with the people of Israel, reminding them in Deuteronomy 7 that they were a holy people, but it had nothing to do with them, really. It was all about God choosing them and keeping his promises to them. And that story informs the continued story of the people of God after Jesus' resurrection. God's been at work in our lives and has been at work in the lives of the Israelite people. But Peter isn't done there. He also quickly uses the term exile in verse 1 to describe the people of God. And here we see that he was originally writing to believers scattered in present-day Turkey. The notion of exile was also an important use of language for Peter, used to summon up another important story from the people of Israel, right, and for these new believers. They too had been in exile, the Israelites, and the Babylonian exile would have been in mind here. But as such, when the people were in exile, they were to remain as God's people, you may remember. In other words, the dominant culture all around them was not to be the story of for the people of God in their context. Jeremiah reminds us of how exiles were to live when the people of God were uprooted from their land, and Moses reminded the Hebrew people to remain distinct, no matter if they were in Egyptian territory or if they were in Canaanite territory. Their job was always to be the people of God, primarily, trusting in God no matter their circumstances, no matter the dominant culture they found themselves in. Peter reiterates that messaging for the post-resurrection community of believers, no matter where they were dispersed to or spread to. And we come now to the next section of our passage, verses 3 to 12, which is the broad category here. And if I were to use one phrase to describe this section, it's, how great our salvation. This broader section has smaller chunks within it, and so I'd like to consider the first chunk in verses 3 to 5 first. Peter goes on in the rest of the book to write about things like holiness, like bearing witness with gentleness and respect and so forth, but he only does so after he lays this theological foundation. Starting again with God, as we zone in on verses 3 to 5, Peter writes that praise ought to be directed towards God the Father of Jesus Christ. The literal language goes like this: blessed be the God and Father of the Lord of us, Jesus Christ. We often think and hope that God will bless us, right? But here God is the one who ought to be blessed, and we need to understand here that blessing can be another word for praising or extolling someone. The reason God ought to be blessed is because he's provided this new birth for us, also known as regeneration. This means believers have their status changed before God and their lifestyle before others, right? There is ramifications for when you follow God. It's not only a standing before God, but also your behavior normally changes in front of other people. But why has God done that? And it seems to me, from the text at least, that it's simply because of his mercy. When we get into the weeds of it, God's mercy is rooted in things like undeserved love for the other and promises that he's kept and so on and so forth. God is the author of all that goodness at his own choosing. And Peter instructs his readers then to ascribe praise to God as a result. And you'll note then a second phrase of importance in verse 3, describing more of what is entailed in this new birth, this regeneration. When you experience this new birth, you are born into a living hope, stuff that we've been singing about, right? Through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, for me at least, this speaks to the immediate benefit of new birth. When we are reborn, regenerated, we are gifted a hope that you knew nothing about. And to put it subversively, we get a sniff that God has a plan for the present and for the future, and we can trust him with that, and we can celebrate that. Speaking of the future, when we participate in this new birth, we are also born into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. And the language here is reminiscent of Romans 8, the first verses there. And because we become God's children, we receive an inheritance in full. This, again, is a benefit of salvation. Somehow, we become heirs with Christ, and that inheritance that is his is ours. People went to the moon a little while ago. I don't understand that, and I don't understand this either. But this is better than that. Again, a benefit of salvation. When we look at the scriptures more broadly, we understand that salvation has various aspects to it, past, present, and future. And these aspects are known as regeneration, these other words that are used for this, regeneration, justification, adoption, sanctification, glorification. And these are all incredible gifts that are given to us as we respond in faith to Jesus' resurrection. Faith, importantly, is a condition that God sets for his people as they respond to this gift of salvation and all that it encompasses. We do need to respond in faith to all of that goodness. Of course, as we see in verses 6 and 7, the next little chunk, we see that salvation is not a free pass where once saved, one no longer has to endure hardship or trial. No, in spite of the joy that salvation brings, suffering, grief, and all kinds of trials are to be expected. Note that Peter suggests that our joy ought to be a part of the present as we reflect on salvation. We do not have to keep all of our joy pent up till that final day when we experience salvation in full and there's high fives all around. Rather, our salvation is impetus for joy even today. And in spite of all that good news, we should not be surprised when things are tough, especially because we follow Christ. One commentator suggests that the suffering and trials of which Peter writes about are those that come upon believers when our lives are being morally, socially, and politically conformed to the way of Jesus Christ, conformity that may put us at odds with the prevailing moral, social, and political realities of the wider world, of the dominant culture, right? Of course, we're going to be at loggerheads at some points. So in addition to the uncontrollability of life that we all experience, the grief, the separation and pain and death that we all experience as human beings, Christians can also expect a whole new level of suffering as well. Good news, isn't it? So, now, why do you think that would be? Well, Peter suggests that the suffering of such trials should be interpreted by Christ's followers as a test of faith, so that the end result might be praise, glory, honor. One author puts it this way: God will set his stamp of approval on faith that has been tested and show this when Christ is revealed. Then the believer will openly share in the praise, glory, and honor of God. These sorts of values are not shared by everybody in society, of course, Yet Peter reminds his readers that we ought to strive for a faith that remains after trial. Some of the rewards of such a faith will be revealed when Jesus returns. We've talked about Easter. We've talked about, I work with churches within the denomination. There's lots of stories about baptisms at Easter, and be encouraged. I mean, there's lots of stuff. God is at work across Western Canada. There's lots of great Easter baptism stories. I was privileged to hear one at our church. I was privileged to hear a testimony on Easter at our church. And this woman went on to describe, she's only been at our church for about 2 years, but she's had a lot of difficulty in her life, lots of difficulty. Husband who left her, then stalked her, and then the second husband died after a short marriage, those sorts of things. And I wasn't able to talk to her after the service, but I did meet her in co-op grocery store during the week. And I went and said a few words to her. And her first words to me were, "I'm not sure why it's had to be so hard." And I said, "Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. But I also know that those trials are there, right, for proving genuine faith in the end. It's a hard lesson. It's a hard thing." In the meantime, and in the present, and I'm looking now at verses 8 and 9. I think Peter is expressing a fair amount of fondness for those who have not experienced Christ like he has. I think Peter would be pretty proud of this group, actually. Even though they have not seen Christ, they love him, and Peter can see it, those first people that he was writing to. Additionally, the believers are filled with joy because they are receiving the goal of faith, the salvation of their souls. Salvation is a process, and sometimes it seems like a long process. But sometimes we need to look to the future and the goal of salvation to help us carry on. As a crude example, when I was a kid, a farmer taught me how to cultivate straight. So back then there wasn't GPS and all that kind of stuff. But remember that hydropole over there, and remember to keep looking at the same one and drive your tractor straight until the end, especially for your first pass, and then work after that on that. And so I remember that every time I mow the lawn now. It's crazy. Anyways, but some of those things are important, right? You look to the future over there, that particular hangar, so I can get there. And that's the goal. I hope some of you have, had better experiences being taught to cultivate. But anyways, Peter continues to describe how great and magnificent salvation is by bringing in a couple of extra witnesses. And here I'm looking specifically at verses 10 and 12. Verses 10 to 11 first speak about the prophets who spoke of this grace that was to come to the believers. They did not know when it would come, those prophets. They didn't have a sure date in mind, those sorts of things. But they knew in broad strokes that God was going to keep his promises and that salvation was going to continue to manifest itself in a Messiah who would experience suffering and also glorification. Peter's point, of course, is that his readers were the first amongst the privileged ones to see that Jesus was the Messiah. And we too are privileged to understand this today, but the first believers after the resurrection were especially so. It's a really remarkable group. But Peter adds to this privilege of salvation, and here I'm referring to the title that I mentioned earlier. He adds to this privilege of salvation by speaking of the angels. I'm no expert on angels, but depending on which translation you use, clearly the angels were also watching with anticipation as salvation was played out more fully. Angels, as it turns out, have an intense interest in human salvation, witnessing the Lord's work. I entitled this Angels on the Edge of Their Seats, and I think this is fairly accurate. The literal translation here is that of angels longing to look into this salvation. And the imagery behind this is that they actually shift their positions in their seats so they can see something better, see something more clearly. In other words, salvation is a really, really big deal with other worldly implications. And it's hard for us to get our minds around it. So as I bring this our time to a close, I do trust the Spirit has been prompting you as you reflect on it. And here are a few implications that have been reiterated to me, at least, as we visited this text. First, I trust that we've been reminded of just how big a deal salvation actually is. Maybe you've been a Christian for a long time and you kind of take your faith for granted. Perhaps you see your salvation as nice to have when things are tough, but not necessarily vital for, you know, all the minor things of life. Or perhaps you've been mainly concerned about a certain aspect of your salvation. You think mainly of the return of Christ and have essentially put all your eggs in that basket. Easter reminds us of a certain emphasis around salvation, that is to be sure. But Peter reminds us that the expansiveness of salvation includes a history, is pertinent now, and will come in the full in the future. And it's bigger than us, even cosmically. It is an incredible privilege to experience salvation, a privilege that the prophets foretold, and one which the angels shift in their seats so as to get a better view. Peter reminds us that salvation is a profound gift made possible by Jesus' resurrection. Thanks be to God. Second, Peter's writings remind us once again that God has taken the initiative to make salvation possible. Peter has a nice way of tying together the narrative of the Old Testament and then bringing that into the new, a new era, right? By using vocabulary that would have been familiar to those who knew the story of the people of Israel. Exile, sojourner, elect, those kinds of words binds the narratives of pre-resurrection people to post-resurrection people. And an important theme is reiterated in our passage. God is the one who, in his mercy, has authored all those narratives. All glory to him. A third implication, for me at least, is that the dominant culture is not for us. We echo what those first believers in Rome would have said. Jesus is Lord. Caesar is not. This will bring about its own trouble. Let's not be naive. The unbelieving world will have something to say, and it won't be kind. This isn't about getting a flat tire on your way to church, folks. It's about obeying Jesus in the midst of a secular culture. This will require strength, and it is a test of the genuineness of our faith. May we embrace the test as it leads to honor and praise of our Lord Jesus Christ. The word stand comes to mind. Implication 4. Perhaps we need to pray for restoration of joy. Finally, and perhaps oddly, given my introduction and my words about David, as I was writing and reflecting on our time today, I remembered his words from Psalm 51. I remember them from a Keith Green song, which is a bit telling. But here is the quote from verse 12. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. I think David reminds us that we can, in fact, lose sight of the privilege and preciousness of salvation. We sometimes fail to see the value of the gift, perhaps because the shimmer has faded away. Or perhaps practically, we don't value salvation in our relationships or in our ministries. And actually, maybe we lean towards only those social expressions of help, which is helpful, of course, and that's good too. Don't get me wrong. But we dare not lose sight of the significance of salvation as we encounter people. And I hope we truly rejoice knowing how good God is in providing all of this stuff for us. I hope you're encouraged. Amen.